Extraordinary careers, extraordinary stories, and for the first time, they're ready to tell them. These are the Narco Warriors. Coming up, the history of the world's second oldest profession, smuggling. Once a national pastime in Britain.
Pretty much everybody was involved, whether you be the magistrate or even the officer.
Where did it begin, and has anything really changed since Roman times?
The Romans, during their occupation of Britain, had similar problems and issues with smugglers.
The vicious band of smugglers who thought they were untouchable, until they found themselves swinging from the end of a rope.
The romanticism started to fade away and people started to realise that smuggling was quite a serious business.
And it was the best of times, the early days of the Customs Investigation Branch, before it went global.
We had the golden moment because we were largely left to our own devices.
Welcome to Narco Warriors. Hello and welcome to Narco Warriors. Well, as you know, we've been looking at the last 50 years of the drug trade, the global drug trade, but we'd like to know where it all began. And I'm very pleased today to say that we have Mike Gough Cooper. Now, Mike spent his professional career with UK Customs and Excise. He had some extraordinary postings. He was our drug liaison officer in Delhi. He worked in Barbados and the Caribbean. And he was also head of maritime operations. But today, Mike is an author and also the unofficial historian of customs and excise and the smuggling industry itself. Welcome, Mike.
Oh, hello, Lindsay. Unofficial historian seems a bit grand, but I accept it.
You said to me that smuggling was the second oldest profession. Just how old is it? How far can we trace it back?
We can establish that since there's been national borders and trade has moved across borders, taxes tend to routinely follow after that. So it's almost inevitable that smuggling has been part of natural culture, national life for many, many generations. Certainly, the movement of people is recorded even in the Bible. I think even Jesus was smuggled out of wherever he was into Egypt at one time. So the profession of smuggling does go back a very long time. I think it was Kipling who identified what he thought was the oldest profession in the world. Smuggling is certainly considered by many people to be the second oldest profession.
Now, apparently it goes back to ancient Carthage. There are actually records showing that smuggling was a problem then.
Yeah, that's right. There are records to show that. And round about the same time, 2,000 years ago in Athens and Carthage, those records exist. And it's strong indications that the Romans, during their occupation of Britain, had similar problems and issues with smugglers.
Smuggling, you say, is a unique crime. It doesn't leave a trace. What do you mean by that?
Well, it is a unique crime. I mean, generally speaking, most of us think of crime in the connection, in the context of there being a complainant, there being somebody who's been disadvantaged as a result of a crime. Obviously, murder, there is a victim. A robbery will leave a victim. And also with murder, they'll leave evidence of a murder. So there'll be maybe a smoking gun, there'll be blood on the carpet, that kind of thing. So an offence takes place, somebody takes umbrage to it, and a crime is reported. In the same way as a jewellery robbery, a brick will end up in the window. But with smuggling, effectively what happens is two people get together in a quiet part of the country, hopefully unobserved, one of them with something they want to pass across a border, and the other one with money that wants to receive it. And the transaction takes place out of the eyes and ears and hearing of anybody. And there's nobody that then really wants to complain about it. So to catch smugglers, we always used to think we had to kind of be there and watch the smuggle take place in order to be in the best position to gather the evidence, because nobody was ever going to complain about it.
There was also the opportunity for quite a lot of corruption. Excise men, I'm sure, would have been in on the trade as well.
Yes, I think that's inevitably true. There is evidence that senior customs officials, senior revenue officials, certainly were in positions to turn blind eyes in the past. And certainly during the period when smuggling was a real national pastime in Britain, the late 18th, early 19th century, there's a huge amount of evidence that pretty much everybody was involved, whether you be the magistrate or even the officer.
How far does excise duty go back in the UK?
Well, the earliest record in the UK, we can take you back to the reign of King Athelbald of Mercia, believe it or not.
That's the 750s, I think, way back.
Yeah, way back, before England had become a proper unified country. Before the reign of King Alfred, King Athelbald ruled a kingdom which incorporated London and the Thames. And there is evidence that he was the first king to levy duty on shipping.
I believe the cash was levied at Billingsgate in those days.
Yes. After that, the Vikings started to make raids into Britain. They'd made raids during various periods of our history, but during the reign of King Ethelred, he famously levied tax on his people in order to get a fund together to deflect the Vikings when they came over to do their raids. Because during the summer season, because it was a sort of a seasonal thing, the Vikings would come up the River Thames. They would often engage in battle with the Anglo-Saxons, and the Anglo-Saxons used to come off second best. And Ethelred decided the way to sort of push them off was a bit like paying a protection racket, really. He collected funds, and when they got off their out of their longboats, they were given the money, which was called Danegeld, and off they hopefully went back to Denmark. Back across the North Sea.
So blackmail does pay at times.
Yes, I think effectively it was a glorified protection racket because the king knew he couldn't really cope with the Viking raiders. I sometimes wonder what it must have been like being one of those Vikings on sort of a junior member of the crew coming across the North Sea, having to endure all that horrible weather, then landing in somewhere like North Kent and perhaps looking forward to a bit of spirited adventure with the local people. A bit of pillaging, and then to be told, well, you've got your money, it's time to go home, and they had to then turn around and go back.
I actually, while I was researching this, I discovered that William the Conqueror himself, after he became King of England, the Vikings were still raiding down the East Coast. He paid them off as well, despite being a fearsome warrior, which, again, it wouldn't have been his own money. It would have been tax raised on the people of England, I'm sure.
Well, that's true. And in fact, that's a common theme, I think, as we talk about this. The common theme really was in the back in the day was that kings needed money generally to pay for wars.
And I suppose 500 years after Athelbald, we've got bad King John. It seems to me most of our medieval kings were pretty either bad or incompetent. But collection of taxes by then had become much more organised.
Yes, that's right. When bad King John came to the throne, he owned Normandy in France, and he lost it very shortly afterwards. And he wanted to raise an army to go and get it back. And that's when he started to really reorganise the way customs duties and taxation in general was collected. He came up with an arrangement whereby all the tax and duty that was collected in the land, he received 1/15th of it, which went directly to him, ostensibly to pay for war. I mean, he was a kind of early day Donald Trump in a way, I suppose. He was using not exactly tariffs, but he was using the collection of taxes for sort of political means.
You describe Robin Hood, who was around at the time, as an example of an early organised crime gang.
And in fact, many of the latter day drug smugglers, you could say, fell into that category. The ones that believed that they had a political cause to fight used drugs trafficking quite a lot to get the money they needed to finance their armies. You know, I can think of two or three. Kunsar in Southeast Asia in the Golden Triangle. He had an army of about 20,000 men. He wanted a free state for his people across the Burmese-Thai border, and he used drug smuggling to finance it.
So if we go back a little bit to sort of King John's time, a little bit earlier, customs houses started to be built all over the country. Whose idea was that, and what were they for?
The earliest recorded place we have for customs duty being collected was in the area of Billingsgate, which is on the north banks of the River Thames, in exactly the same place as where the modern custom house is now. So the modern custom house can trace its ancestry back to the place on the Thames where King Ethelred collected his first duty, which is, I think, quite extraordinary. But it was in the time of King John who wanted to set up regional tax offices and custom houses, which were kind of mini fortresses in a way, because they had to, they were part exchequer as well. So they collected money and they had to keep the money safe. So it was when King John started to really reorganize the whole way that tax was collected and duties were collected, the custom houses started to spring up. And certainly on Wool Quay, which again is right next to Billingshurst in Lower Thames Street, the modern day Lower Thames Street in London, during the reign of King Edward I, who some might remember him as known as Longshanks, he constructed the very first proper building on Wool Quay in about 1270, 1275. And its building, it was replaced subsequently by a building that during the Tudor period. And that, I have an image of that building, which was burned down in the Great Fire of London. And that building was replaced by a very grand design from Christopher Wren when he was pretty much re-architecturing the whole of London. And his custom house burned down, and that was replaced by another one, which also burned down. And I come to think, you know, a trend is beginning to develop here about all these custom houses burning down. And you wonder whether there was accident or any intent involved in it. But suffice to say, the modern iteration of the London Custom House is also a very grand building, built in 1817. It was bombed during the Blitz and the East Wing was burned out, but it still stands. It was built in 1817 and it still stands to this day.
Many years ago, I was fortunate enough to go into the building and see that magnificent room, the hall, where the counting hall, if you like, which is probably one of the last places you worked. But I always remember too that beneath Customs House was the Customs Warehouse, which was full at that time of seized drugs. And you got quite a trip just walking in the front door. Do you remember that?
Well, I do. I do. And I remember the room you're referring to is called the Long Room.
Yep.
And it was the room, as you said, where merchants and importers would assemble to have their paperwork checked by the customs officials at that time. And it's a very grand room. Underneath that building was the Queen's Warehouse in our day, and it's now called the King's Warehouse, where everything of contraband was stored over the years. And subsequently, drugs were stored there that we'd seized in various parts of the UK. And certainly cannabis produces a very kind of sickly sweet smell, which tended to permeate some of the corridors close by to the old Queen's Warehouse. And you know, some said that people didn't really need to go out for a drink at lunchtime. They just needed to stay in the close environments to feel happy enough to carry on with their work in the afternoon.
I imagine that's not used anymore.
No, that's not used. I mean, the Custom House effectively has been sold from the Crown Estate and it's about to be converted into a grand hotel. But within the Queen's Warehouse, there was also another thing called the Queen's Pipe or the King's Pipe, which was a device which was used to incinerate and burn everything that needed to go that way, particularly narcotics. So from time to time, there would be burnings and everything was lumped into that and the smoke would go up from the top of the building. And I remember taking my grandsons on one of those boat cruises down the Thames a few years ago, and the boat character, we were going past the London Custom House and he announced to everybody, all the American Japanese tourists on board the boat, he said, on the left you can see the London Custom House, he says, and in that place, that's where they store all the drugs. He says, I've never ever had the fortune to ever be in there, he said, but I understand they have the best Christmas parties in all of London.
So that chimney had been a giant reefer for years and years, it sounds like to me.
Effectively, yes.
The other extraordinary thing about the history of customs and excise and smuggling is the number of famous people who have been excise officers. I've got a long list here, but can we start with Geoffrey Chaucer? What did he do as an excise man?
Chaucer, who was obviously the first man to write in English, I think it was about 1370s, he was appointed as the controller of wools, skins and tanned hides. In those days, funnily enough, duty was paid on the export of things as much as it was on the import of things. And because Britain was very productive in terms of the wool trade, and we had a lot of sheep knocking around, the government in their wisdom decided to charge duty on the export. And that was his his job was to be in charge of that whole business. From what I've learned, he had the grand salary of about £6 a year for doing that job. And he worked in that job for at least 10, 15 years, I believe. And there is a record of him being involved in capturing a man who was involved in the act of smuggling, whose name was John of Kent, presumably wool smuggling. And for that, Chaucer sort of trebled his annual salary. And he got a more than £17 seizure award for his work against the smuggler John of Kent, which dwarfed his annual salary by quite a lot.
That's pretty much three years' salary. I assume you weren't rewarded in quite the same way during your career, Mike.
Unfortunately not. We never got any rewards. During my early days, seizure awards still existed for airports and port officers. So if they came across something, they would, I think, when they were phased out, a seizure award amounted to something like, it was limited to about £40. So it kind of encouraged officers to, apart from doing their normal work, if they, the more seizures they made, the more seizure awards they could get and the richer they could become.
Along the list as well here, we've got Dick Whittington of Lord Mayor of London fame and Cat fame, Daniel Defoe, John Dryden, who was also the poet laureate. And apparently in Dryden's time, they were collecting money to support a couple of things. The first being the English Secret Service. Is that true?
Yes, I believe so. I think the history of the English Secret Service had preceded the reign of Charles II, who was the king that Dryden worked for. But Dryden was given a particular job of collecting revenue, which went directly to the support of the English Secret Service, which is something that Charles II was particularly fond of. I mean, I think it was a time of great intrigue. I mean, it wasn't very long after the great intrigues of the Tudors and the kind of novels you read about that. But yes, the English Secret Service was largely supported by the collection of customs duties. And the other thing that, rather amusingly, that Dryden used to have to do, he had a customs officer, a revenue officer, who every month he sent down to visit Nell Gwynn, who was the king's mistress. I don't know whether she was a secret mistress. I think she was fairly well declared, as it were, in customs terms. And then, as people used to joke, she used to work under the king.
Also, Robert Burns, the famous Scottish poet, was also a revenue officer.
Yes, he was actually technically an excise officer, but in those days he was brought into to do smuggling type duties as well. He was based on the southwest coast of Scotland and around a place called Dumfries. And there is a record of him towards the end of the 18th century, I think it's 1798, 1799, of him boarding a vessel that had actually run aground off the coast, but was believed to be carrying contraband. And he waded out into the water with his cutlass in hand, so they say, and seized the crew and the vessel and seized the contraband. And that was his kind of venture. And apparently the story goes that whilst his band of revenue officers were waiting for the vessel to be boarded, they got some information. They waited and he wrote a famous poem about the excise, which wasn't entirely complimentary, basically saying that the devil and the excise men were in some way in cahoots with one another. He didn't have a very high opinion of his own superiors, though I think he enjoyed some of the job that he did.
So by the mid-19th century, it's pretty much a national pastime, smuggling. What was owling?
Owling was the term which was used to describe smugglers in certain quarters. I mean, smuggling, as you quite rightly said, had become pretty much a national pastime. Pretty much everybody in the community was either involved in it or benefited from it, from the clergy to the magistrates to even judges to senior members of the army. We all seemed to be involved in it. But one of the methods that the smugglers used to use at night when they were bringing their cargo ashore, they used to have a fairly complicated system of lookout. They used to do bird calls to one another, imitating owls in the night.
Really?
To basically say that the coast was clear or the coast wasn't clear. So they became owlers, the ones that went out to mimic the owls. And there are all sorts of other stories. There's a story of a magistrate on the Isle of Sheppey. He was a pigeon fancier. And because he pretty much financed the runs of rum and tea that came across the coast there in his time, he was given first dibs, first show of the contraband. And he gave the smugglers one of his pigeons. And when they had landed the goods on the beach and the coast was clear, they'd release the pigeon. The pigeon would come back into the magistrate's loft. And when he saw it arrive, he knew that he could go out and pick up his goods.
Fantastic story. There is a lot of romance, I suppose, around smuggling. You know, sort of boats under muffled oars coming into coves in the middle of the night with bottles of rum and skins and what have you. But was it a romantic sort of way of life? It sounds to me like there was quite a lot of violence involved.
It became extraordinarily cutthroat because effectively rival gangs wanted a piece of the action, a bit like organised crime, and they were prepared to do anything that they needed to do to A, outwit the revenue officials, and B, keep their piece of territory. I mean, the most famous and most notorious vicious gang, I suppose, in southeast England was the Hawkhurst gang based in Sussex, just north Sussex, south Kent, around the village of Hawkhurst. They were expecting a ship to come in with contraband containing tea and brandy, but the ship was intercepted by a revenue cutter operating off the coast, and the ship was captured and taken into Poole Harbour. And the goods were unloaded, and the goods were loaded into the custom house on the quay of Poole Harbour. They weren't going to lie down quietly about this, so they decided they were going to get the contraband back. So they formed a group of like a posse of men. They rode their horses down, crossed the border into Hampshire, and they met up with another gang based in Chichester. And together they approached the custom house at Poole with the idea of raiding it. What they then found was that the revenue cutter with its cannon on board, the guns on board, was sitting in the bay with its guns trained on the front doors of the custom house. But then somebody noticed that when the tide went down, the customs vessel also went down in the water and the guns went down. And all of a sudden, the guns weren't any longer trained on the doors of the custom house. So they burst in and they took what they wanted to. And they found that they took what they could carry. And in those days, what they carried back was the tea. They had to leave the brandy because it was too heavy, but they took the tea back, which was worth a fortune. And on their way back, they were greeted by a cheering crowd. Every village they came through, they were treated as conquering heroes. Such was the support they got. But there was one man who spotted them and was given a packet of tea by one of the Hawkhurst smugglers. And he, for some reason, he was a shoemaker called Daniel Chater. And he decided that he was prepared to give evidence against the Hawkhurst gang. So the revenue commissioners sent an old officer down to pick him up and bring him to the magistrate where he could give his evidence. And they started to make their way back and they fell into a pub in Hampshire near Rowland's Castle, I think. Little did they know the pub was owned by a notorious gang of local smugglers who recognized them for what they were doing. And when they got them drunk, when they found inside the revenue officer's papers giving him his orders of going to collect this man to come as a witness, they realized they'd captured two guys. So they brought the rest of the Hawkhurst gang in and they put these poor two into a terrible, they tortured them. And eventually they got the informer and they threw him down a well. And there was such a lot of outcry, this viciousness, that the local gentry, led strangely by somebody called the Duke of Richmond, who apparently lived in Sussex, he decided that he's had enough of this. So he rounded up everyone he could, including the Hawkhurst gang. They stood trial and they were hanged, and that was the end of them. But then old Richmond went a little bit too far and he started to arrest pretty much anybody on general suspicion of being smugglers. And 40, 50, 60 people, I think, were taken into custody and ended up at the wrong end of a rope. There was a bit of a purge at that time. So that was a moment where the romanticism started to fade away and people started to realise that smuggling was quite a serious business.
That is an extraordinary story. And it shows that sort of violence, intimidation, torture. I mean, we know about this from the modern cartels, but it's hundreds of years old, the same techniques, the same consequences if you're on the wrong side of a smuggling gang.
Yes, exactly. This was 1748, nearly 300 years ago.
And also, one of the extraordinary things about customs and excise men was that they had something called a writ of assistance, which sounds bureaucratic, but it's incredibly powerful. I believe it says that you can enter any house, shop, cellar, warehouse, or other place to break any door, trunk, chest, case, pack, trap, or any other parcel or package, whatever, which just basically means you don't need to go to a judge for a search warrant.
The government decided that they needed to get tough, and they gave revenue officers this power, which I believe still exists. It certainly existed in my day when I was working as an officer. And from time to time, I used that very same writ myself. And it meant we had to do it very carefully, and we had to account for it every time. But it did mean that we could follow the drugs. The idea was that if you went into a house and you searched it, and then you learned that the drugs had moved to the house next door or had gone to a house in another neighborhood, you could follow the drugs and go with the writ and use that on many different premises on the same night. And it meant that we didn't have to go in front of a magistrate to get a search warrant, which the police used to have to do. I have a copy at home of a thing called the Boston writ, which was issued in the 18th century in Boston, in the then colonies of the Americas. And the writ applied there as much as it did in the UK or in England. And it was hugely misused by the colonial forces, the army and the revenue officials, to as an excuse to search possible patriot homes or rebels' homes. And as you know, the taxation thing was a big issue in the creation of the War of Independence against the British Crown.
Yes, Thomas Paine, who wrote The Rights of Man, said that it was one of the causes of the War of Independence.
Yes, he put it down to the misuse of the writ of assistance was one of the major grudges that convinced the powers in those days that they needed to fight a war against us. You know, they'd had the Boston Tea Party and all that, but the writ, the misuse of the writ had dramatic international and lasting consequences.
Mike, is it true customs officers actually have a commission?
Yes, that is true, Lindsay. They had a commission in much in the same way as an army officer might have a commission. Once you reached a certain rank in the service, you got very proudly a document that was signed by the commissioners of customs, which set out the commission and some of the powers that you held as an officer of customs and excise. In fact, one of the powers that's contained in the Commission for Customs Officers is the power to call on members of the armed forces and constables to assist the officer in his work. In fact, I could read from the commission, which I'm holding my own commission in my hand here. It says that the officer can require all and every constable and member of Her Majesty's Armed Forces or Coast Guard and all others whom it may concern to be aiding and assisting him in all things as becometh the said, and then the name of the officer is inserted there. And in fact, this is a particularly important thing because we used to have to use that quite a lot. And certainly in my career, I used to have to go and meet the military and ask them to help us as aid to the civil power, as we used to call it. And it's ensconced in that document that goes back hundreds of years.
That sounds to me as if it makes customs officers the most powerful law enforcement officers that we have, especially with the writ of assistance too.
Yeah, I certainly think we thought that, but we were constantly reminded by our superiors never to overstep the mark of it. And we kind of knew that we had. In fact, many police officers used to say to me when we were working together, "You guys, I wish we had the powers that you guys had because we'd be able to solve a lot more crime," which wasn't true, of course, but that was sometimes their view.
A little later on in Victorian times, it was the customs and excise were becoming not only more professional, but then they formed a dedicated team of revenue investigators. What's the story behind that?
The reason why there was so much duty and there was so much smuggling in that period was because of the war with France. But once the war was over, the duties were reduced a lot and the powers came down, the number of officers came down. But there was still an issue in those days with excise duty. And one of the considerations was duty on illicit, a duty on whiskey and duty on gin. And we've learned that in 1850, a small band of men was created called the Excise Detectives, or the Detective Crew, based at Tower Hill in London. There were only about four or six of them at the time. And their job was to be a proper investigator to try and root out and find out where these stills were and try and make sure that people paid the correct amount of duty. Excise and the customs were separate departments. They were linked, but they were separate. The customs created their own special service unit for investigators. And when the departments merged in 1909 to become HM Customs and Excise, the two investigation functions were brought together.
And apparently they had to be young and vigorous with courage and resource. Is that how you remember most of your colleagues in the early days?
Absolutely. I couldn't have described them any better. There was quite a lot of secrecy attached to the office of investigation in the 20th century. And it was true even in those days that some senior members of the Board of Customs didn't even know that they had an investigation function working for them. It was kept from people so much.
I wonder why it was such a secret.
Maybe it was born out of some ancient idea that they had, that need to know, which was a phrase that we used a lot in our own day. If you didn't need to know something, you weren't told, even if it was an investigation which was happening in the next office to you.
Now, you worked in the investigation branch, didn't you, yourself? The idea of the IB was largely driven by a man called Sam Charles. He was obviously a very important figure in the development of the modern customs and excise.
Yes, I think he was, particularly when it came to the investigation of drugs. Until then, the work of the investigator was a revenue job. And the investigation of the prohibitions that came to the UK was a different matter. And that was called an assigned matter. And others used to call it agency work. And in fact, in my very early part of my career, the old style officers used to kind of look down their noses, us drugs investigators, and talk of us rather dismissively of doing agency work. It wasn't proper. In other words, it wasn't proper customs revenue work. We were doing this dirty drugs business, which was a prohibition. But during the 60s, drugs was a crime that came to prominence and it started to become a social problem. And nobody really gripped it in law enforcement. Certainly the police didn't grip it. And it was Sam Charles, I think, one of the very first people that realized that the customs had an important role to play in this. And he took the lead in it and started to attend conferences around the world with other mostly police officers. And in America, I know he had a famous conference, I think, with President Nixon in America representing customs. And as a result, we started to gain prominence. And when the guidelines were started to be introduced about who did what, it was our historical links to law enforcement going back many centuries and the ability to understand the way smuggling worked and the importance of intelligence in terms of that, that gave us a lead into it. And before we kind of knew where we were, with Sam Charles at the helm and Dougie Jordan, who was the then chief investigation officer, we suddenly found ourselves with a very important remit, and drugs teams investigating different types of drugs started to spring up.
Was it a very exciting time then to have joined UK Customs and Excise in the 70s?
Extraordinary. I mean, from my point of view, it was most unexpected, but it was, and I think all of us that served from the 70s right up until the early 2000s, when the service was subsumed into what is now the National Crime Agency, I think we had the best of times, really. We had the golden moment because we were largely left to our own devices. We had our own prosecution agency, our own prosecution service, so we didn't have to go to the Crown Prosecution Service agency to do our work. The work of the investigator was still very, very small in the context of the department. The department, I think, when I joined, was about 22, 25,000 strong, and the investigation division, which is the one I joined just after the branch in 75, had about 300 in it. So, and of those 300, probably only about 80 to 100 were investigating drugs. It didn't matter where it was in the country. We had a national remit. Just as a little aside, I do remember in my first couple of weeks of joining the department, I had no idea that I'd end up being an investigator. I kind of joined because my dad told me it was about time I got a job, actually. I ended up on a training course, and at the end of the training course, the course was designed to give you an outline of what the Customs and Excise did in its every capacity, from the VAT that it looked after, from the water guard officers that worked at the airports. Every facet was described to us. And we had a half an hour lecture on investigation over 3 days, which is very little. And it was like all very secretive. At the end of it, I put my hand up and I asked a question. I said, what opportunity might I have in the department to serve overseas? Because in my naive juvenile way, I imagined that because customs was to do with borders and movement of goods, there must be some function whereby officers might want to collaborate with their colleagues in France or somewhere. And I was told, none whatsoever, young man. If you'd wanted to go abroad, you should have joined the bloody Foreign Office. So we had no idea really what we were getting ourselves. Well, I certainly had no idea what I was getting myself in for, and it was a wonderful ride.
Well, how wrong that person was, because you then found yourself in India, you found yourself in Miami, you found yourself in Barbados, you found yourself running the Qatar Squadron around the British Isles. What an extraordinarily varied and interesting career you've had, Mike. Of course, nothing's changed. It's maybe drugs today, but it was alcohol, it was spices 2,000 years ago. But the basics of smuggling just have never changed at all, have they?
No, they haven't changed. I mean, you can divide into two areas. You can divide it into concealment. People who smuggle either conceal or they avoid. One of the two, it's been the same. Otherwise, they avoid where the customs officer is. They go around the corner and they smuggle out of sight and out of mind, or they try and hoodwink the customs officer by concealing something in a bag or in something sophisticated. There are only two ways of doing it, and they've been the same for as long as anyone knows.
Mike, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thanks very much for joining Narco Warriors. Next week on Narco Warriors, we take a look back at the series so far and ask, will Belgium become Europe's first narco state? All the evidence suggests that an ocean of cocaine flowing through the port of Antwerp is corrupting institutions and undermining law and order. Also, we're joined by customs investigator Barry Clark, who tells us the inside story of the hunt for Mickey Green, one of Britain's most wanted drug smugglers. In his heyday, he was the archetypal Costa del Crime villain, a swaggering expat gangster who inspired the movie Sexy Beast. From armed robberies to drug and money laundering networks stretching from Europe to the US, everyone knew his name, but nobody could ever quite take him down. This is how international investigators finally got to Mickey Green, and why he still walked free. These are the Narco Warriors. Join us again soon.